program is made possible in part by KABU Foundation members and a grant from Cotton Cloud Futons, a locally owned business featuring futons and mattresses, frames, covers, furnishings, and accessories which can be made with organic and recycled materials. Cotton Cloud is located at 701 Northeast Broadway in Portland. Information at 503-335-0758 or cottoncloudfutons.com.
Coming up on the KABU Evening News, troops in Iraq and Afghanistan will receive new equipment and a pay raise. Doctors find hope in drug that eases cancer. The Intifada continues 6 years later and no end in sight.
And in the human cost of occupation in Iraq, as of today, there have been 2,706 officially acknowledged deaths of American soldiers. IraqBodyCount.org reports as many as 48,343 civilians have been reported killed by the military intervention in Iraq. The website InformationClearinghouse.info reports the true civilian casualty rate may be as high as 250,000 dead.
Good evening. This is the KABU Evening News for Friday, September 29, 2006. I'm Annalisa Hummel.
And I'm Julie Sabatier. Over 100,000 Oregon children, 18 and under, suffer the daily consequences of being uninsured, including paying the highest prices for prescription drugs. According to a new Families USA report released today in Eugene by the coalition supporting Measure 44, Prescription for a Healthy Oregon, 92% of Oregon's uninsured children come from a household with at least one working parent. Measure 44 is the only health care reform measure to qualify for the November 7th general election. If passed, it will lower prescription drug costs for the 1 million Oregonians who don't have drug coverage, including well over 100,000 children. The program is already established with a proven track record. It delivers up to 60% lower drug prices and pays for itself. The fiscal impact statement filed with the Oregon Secretary of State indicates there is no additional cost to taxpayers. Key findings in the Family USA report include that 9% of Oregon's children under the age of 6 are uninsured, and uninsured children are nearly 5 times as likely as insured children to have at least one delayed or unmet health care need.
Chemeketa Community College Board of Education has approved free tuition for dependents of Oregon military personnel who have died on duty since September 11, 2001. The free tuition benefit is part of a package labeled Chemeketa's Response to 9/11. College employees activated by the military will receive leave without pay from the college for up to 5 years, and their dependents will continue to receive tuition waivers during that active duty period. Veterans who were disabled 50% or more while on duty after September 11, 2001 will have their tuition waived for up to 100 credits or attainment of an associate degree, provided that satisfactory academic progress is being made. The free tuition for spouses of fallen veterans also extends to 100 credits or a degree. The waiver for veterans' children extends to their 21st birthday. Julie?
Thank you, Annalisa. The Environmental Protection Agency is in the process of closing parts of its library system this weekend. Some of its 27 libraries have already been closed, including the headquarters library. KABU's Kathleen Stevenson spoke with Jeff Rook of PEER, Public Employees for Environmental Responsibility, about what the public will lose with these closings.
What's the effect of this for people who are interested in environmental preservation and finding out information about environmental issues?
The ability of the public to access EPA's holdings are going to be greatly compromised, and in many instances, substitutes like, say, for example, the Freedom of Information Act are going to be difficult to utilize because you won't know what documents you're asking for, and the agency won't be able to do a search to determine what it is they're even holding. In sort of a very general way, the ability of EPA to inform the people that it works for, the public, about the state of the environment will be substantially diminished.
They have mentioned this possible online service?
Yes, they have. The rationale is that they're going to make all of these holdings available online, and if that were the case, that would be great, and we would be applauding them rather than pointing to them with alarm. But they don't have a budget for doing that or a schedule. And one of the things that I think was indicative of their mindset is when they first proposed this back in February, one of the things they were eliminating funding for was their electronic card catalog. We were able to talk them into restoring the $500,000 for that. But had they eliminated the electronic card catalog, no one would be able to tell what they held. I mean, it was completely nuts. The other thing about it is that the information specialists within the agency themselves are being kept in the dark as to what's going on and aren't being clued in as to what the overall plan is going to be, so that information, they can continue to provide information services to their own staff and the public. As we understand it from the very weaselly worded press statements that EPA issues about once every month in response to growing questions about this, the agency itself is still trying to figure out what to do.
What can people do who are interested in this and concerned about this?
The only thing, and this is going to sound trite, but the only thing we can think of to urge is for them to contact their member of Congress. Unless Congress intervenes and actually exercises its power of the purse, the administration's pretty much able to reallocate money as they see fit. And this is such a small item. It's something like a $2 million item in an almost $8 billion budget. It's so small that it doesn't have a specific line in the budget. There is no line item for the libraries. So Congress has to affirmatively act to forbid the administration from using funds in a way that both ends access to these collections to the public and their own staff. The congressional session is in the process of recessing today, Friday, until after the election. And so all of this is going to be basically kind of on hold until a lame duck session that begins sometime in November. In the meantime, the administration is going to continue to be free to shut more library units.
And the website for PEER, again, there's more information there?
It's peer.org, and on the homepage there's a EPA Library Center, and you just click on the stack of books.
I want to thank you very much for speaking with us, Jeff Rook of PEER, and that's P-E-E-R, www.peer.org.
That was KBOO's Kathleen Stevenson speaking with Jeff Rook of PEER. Local police chiefs say the key to crime prevention in the future is giving youngsters the key to early success. Hillsborough Police Chief Ron Louie and Cornelius Police Chief Paul Rubenstein visited the Hillsborough Head Start Center. They toured the program and read to some of the children on Wednesday. At a press conference Tuesday, they spoke of Head Start education as one of the most effective ways of ensuring successful development. Louie and Rubenstein are members of Fight Crime, Invest in Kids Oregon, a bipartisan anti-crime organization of 126 police chiefs, sheriffs, district attorneys, other law enforcement leaders, and violence survivors. The program's director, Marta Brooks, joined the chiefs on the trip. Fight Crime, Invest in Kids Oregon estimates that by providing high-quality Head Start education to all eligible at-risk Oregon children, as many as 500 children could be prevented from committing crimes when they grow up, ensuring a brighter future for them and their community.
U.S. Congressman Peter DeFazio has announced that he helped secure funding for several important projects, including research at three Oregon universities, in the Department of Defense Appropriations Act for fiscal year 2007. The act passed in the House yesterday. Overall, the bill provides $447.6 billion, including $70 billion, in funding for U.S. troops in Iraq and Afghanistan. The bill provides $1 billion for body armor and other personal protection equipment, and a 2.2% pay increase for the troops. The bill also includes $17.1 billion for new and refurbished equipment for troops returning from Iraq, $1.9 billion to counter roadside bombs, and $549 million for enhanced life insurance and death benefits for military families. The bill marks the first time that Congress has approved legislation that prohibits the construction of permanent U.S. bases in Iraq and prohibits U.S. control over Iraqi oil.
the opening of the largest Northwest Solar Energy Expo ever hosted in Oregon at the Convention Center started today. KBOO's Marlies Franklin was there and spoke with various people about the future of solar energy.
The Northwest Solar Expo of 2006 is underway at the Oregon Convention Center until Sunday. During his opening presentation, Mike Graney, the director of the Oregon Department of Energy, stated that over 20,000 people have taken advantage of the residential energy tax credit. Also, residential use of solar energy has increased from 42 4 years ago to 134 last year. The use of solar energy in Oregon has expanded to include farms, schools, and factories. Jeff Bissonette, the organizing director of the Fair and Clean Energy Coalition of the Citizens Utility Board, spoke of the Clean Energy Agenda, which will be presented to the 2007 legislative session.
In Oregon, what we're looking at is a broad range of clean energy resources, from energy efficiency to solar to wind to geothermal to biomass. And so we, as a state, we need to look at the full range of clean energy that we have. And so it's from that that we are proposing a clean energy agenda for the 2007 legislative session. And there's a broad grassroots based effort behind that to make sure that current things that are being done to, for instance, investments in energy efficiency, investments in renewable resources across the board are supported, and then building on that to make sure that at least 25% of Oregon's electric need is met by renewable resources by 2025, to make sure that building codes encourage renewable resources and energy efficiency, and that the current tax credits are expanded to make sure that not just solar, but all renewable resources can benefit from the tax credits that are currently available.
In Oregon, various types of renewable energies are used, such as wind, wave, solar, and geothermal, to name a few. Bissonette explains why it's important to keep the options open when deciding on a particular type of renewable energy.
I think what we want to do is, because all of the industries are fairly new and are really coming up and are being developed, we don't want to pick winners right now. Costs are going to come down at different levels for different industries. You know, for right now, wind is very cost competitive, and so we want to make sure that the best technology rises to the surface kind of on its own, and to make sure that all of the resources, tax credits and other resources are available for all industries.
Jeremiah Bauman, environmental advocate with Osberg, went on to explain about the various state programs and other avenues one can investigate to obtain renewable energy.
I think the other thing about it, the good news is that renewable energy is very grassroots, bottom-up industry. I mean, the important thing that for how we build this industry, both solar and other renewable energy forms, is we put the right policies in place. So there are grants available, there are low-interest loans available from the Department of Energy, there are tax credits available, and then there are also incentives from the Energy Trust of Oregon. You know, they will give you up to $10,000 off of a solar energy system for your roof. So there's all sorts of policies that are important, because they not only make it financially easier, but they set up a policy environment where investment in renewable energy makes sense. There are venture capitalist investors who will tell you they look for the states with the strongest policies, not just the tax credits to encourage it, but also the standards that say Oregon will be 25% renewable by 2025. That's a signal to them that Oregon's a good place to invest in renewable energy.
Troy Gagliano, the senior policy advocate for the Renewable Northwest Project, provided some data as to where Oregon stands.
Oregon certainly has taken some good steps in the last several years to advance renewables, but the fact is we're still at less than 2% of our electricity from clean resources like wind, geothermal, solar. But Governor Kulongoski's proposed 25% renewable energy standard certainly takes us to a next level. And it shows that we're, as a state, going to get serious about protecting customers from volatile fossil fuel prices, about combating global energy, using homegrown energy resources, and providing really a healthy future for our kids, too. This is just some interesting facts, and Jeremiah had talked a bit about the economic development coming from renewable energy, and this is for the wind projects, five different wind projects in Oregon and Washington in just the last 12 months. It's 755 megawatts worth of wind turbines, and it represents $1.1 billion worth of investment in these rural communities. It's over 800 jobs that are being created for building these projects, and it's adding about $5 million in property tax to the rural counties in Oregon and Washington.
This is Marlise Franklin with KBOO News at the Northwest Solar Expo at the Convention Center until Sunday.
Seattle police say they were investigating the arrest that led to a discrimination complaint against three officers. The complaint has been filed with the Office of Professional Accountability. The NAACP is calling for the officers to be fired. The incident involves two 19-year-old women, one white and one black, who were stopped at a gas station early Monday when they were harassed by a group of men. The men were gone by the time police arrived. A police report says the women appeared intoxicated and agitated, and the officers thought they had been fighting. Officers arrested them for an investigation of assault. The NAACP says they were treated differently. The white woman apparently was placed in the back seat of a police car without handcuffs, while the black woman was pushed into the back of the car and handcuffed.
British Columbia's Kelsey Middleton is modeling a much shorter haircut. The 9-year-old decided to donate 5 14-inch ponytails of her long, thick hair. Why share her hair? The ponytails are being donated to Locks for Love, which is a well-established non-profit organization dedicated to collecting donated hair for children's wigs. The group provides custom-made and fitted wigs to children who suffer from long-term medical hair loss, such as children undergoing chemotherapy for cancer. Kelsey is not the only local person who has donated her hair. Besides raising more than $1,000, Alicia Wiebe will donate her hair next Thursday during a pancake breakfast at Thrifty Foods as part of a visit with the Tour de Rock Cops for Cancer Riders.
An experimental drug that extends the lives of lung cancer patients by a third has impressed doctors who say that it is one of the first signs of progress against the disease. Lung cancer is among the most lethal of all cancers and claims more lives each year than any other type of cancer. Only 5% of patients survive more than 5 years after diagnosis. Efforts to find an effective treatment have failed, and unlike other cancers such as breast cancer, the death rate has not changed for more than a decade. A trial of the as-yet-unnamed drug known as AS-1404 was conducted. In 70 patients with non-small cell lung cancer, the most common kind, the trial found the patients lived for 14 months on average compared with 8.8 months for those given chemotherapy alone. Although the extra 5 months gained is small in absolute terms, it is a significant improvement, suggesting a genuine benefit from the drug. The success of the Phase 2 study lays the ground for a larger Phase 3 trial, the outcome of which will determine whether the drug will be licensed as safe and effective. AS-1404 has already been shown to be effective in Phase 2 trials of prostate and ovarian cancer. Annalisa?
Thank you. During most of her long life, Roberta Langtree was an unassuming elementary school teacher in Toronto, Canada. She always shied away from the limelight and spent many years during her career trying to help autistic children with their speaking difficulties. Ms. Langtree, who died last year at the age of 89, carried an unusual financial secret that has been revealed only after her death. Unknown to almost everyone who knew her, including her closest friends, the modestly paid teacher was a multimillionaire who, through a bequest, has given what is believed to be the largest donation from an individual to an environmental cause in Canada. Ms. Langtree asked that more than $4.3 million of her estate be given to the Nature Conservancy of Canada, a charity that buys environmentally sensitive land and turns it into nature reserves. The conservancy plans to use the money to buy more wetlands and help safeguard the Oak Ridges Moraine, a pastoral rural area north of Toronto. Up until now, the largest donation the conservancy has received from an individual was approximately $1 million, Julie.
Cincinnati has become a leading voice in a rising global protest against the genocide taking place in Darfur, Sudan. Former Cincinnati television anchor Nick Clooney, father of the famous actor George Clooney, has commenced 5 days for Darfur. Mayor Mark Mallory designated Wednesday through Sunday as 5 days for Darfur in the city. The proclamation was read Wednesday morning by Councilman David Crowley at the kickoff of the Darfur Awareness Program at the National Underground Railroad Freedom Center. In the last 3 years, more than 400,000 people have been killed in Darfur by government-backed Arab militias called the Janjaweed. The victims are farmers and their wives and children. The militias are killing people, raping women, and burning villages in areas of Sudan inhabited primarily by black Africans. Clooney and his son George went to the Darfur region of Sudan to videotape footage of the refugees who have been forced from their home fleeing from the genocide.
And now, 20 minutes after 5 o'clock, time for another commentary from Jim Hightower.
The saga of Tom DeLay just keeps getting curiouser and curiouser. And I'm not even talking about the myriad of legal and ethics charges against him. Having been indicted for money laundering, he lost favor back home, so Tom decided to quit his re-election campaign. He then showed the home folks just how much he thinks of them by declaring that he really isn't one of them and doesn't even consider himself a Texan. In a legal bid to take his name off the Texas ballot, DeLay swore that he's actually been a resident of a Washington, D.C. suburb for some time. He says that he lives in a Virginia condo, carries a Virginia driver's license, pays Virginia taxes, even votes in Virginia, and plans to keep living and working there rather than returning home. What will Tom be doing, assuming he avoids jail? Well, he'll cash in, of course, doing some influence peddling for big bucks. But he also asserts that he'll continue to, quote, engage in the important cultural and political battles of our day. Such as? Well, such as using his influence to swing the vote in a ballroom dancing contest on television. A TV show called Dancing with the Stars allows viewers to vote on their favorite. It's a sort of survivor for hoofers. And Tom recently zapped out an urgent email to his political supporter list, asking all of them to watch and vote for one Sarah Evans. She's a country singer who performed at the 2004 Republican National Convention. So now Tom's backing her in a dance contest. He says that Sarah, quote, has been a strong supporter of the Republican Party and represents good American values. This is Jim Hightower saying, great. It's always uplifting to get advice about good American values from an indicted money launderer and a recidivist ethics violator. Still, it's better for Tom to be hustling ballroom dancing votes than selling votes in Congress to corporate campaign donors.
This Jim Hightower commentary has been brought to you by the United Steelworkers, the union committed to winning every employee's right to choose representation free from fear of being intimidated or fired. Visit us on the World Wide Web at usw.org.
Stay tuned for Counterspin at 5:30 following this newscast. At 6 p.m., it's Bread and Roses. Tomorrow's weather, after the fog clears, bask in a mostly sunny Saturday with temperatures in the high 70s. You're listening to the KBOO Evening News, Portland, Corvallis, Vancouver, and Hood River.
Years ago today, the uprising known as the Al-Aqsa Intifada began in the Palestinian-occupied territories after then-Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon paid a visit to the Al-Aqsa Mosque in Jerusalem, the third holiest site in Islam. 6 years later, the Intifada continues. FSRN Saeed Banoura reports from Palestine.
4,248 Palestinians have been killed in the last 6 years of open conflict, 20% of whom were children, 80% of whom were civilians not involved in fighting, according to the Palestinian Bureau of Statistics. In the same period, the Israeli military estimates that 1,115 Israelis were killed, of whom they estimate 70% were civilians. The Israeli statistics include as civilians people who live in military-occupied Palestine. Abdul Halim with the Palestinian Center for Human Rights in Gaza.
Silence is an international conspiracy against the Palestinian civilian population in an attempt to make them bow down and abandon their rights. On this anniversary, we wish to tell the world that the Palestinians did not and will not accept the Israeli violations that reject all laws and regulations. We demand that the world intervene immediately and enforce the international laws and regulations and to respect the will of the Palestinian people in their democratic choice for their government.
Palestinians hope for a peace agreement that will end the Intifada. The first Intifada from 1987 to 1993 was known as the Intifada of Stones, as it consisted mainly of young boys throwing stones at invading Israeli tanks and soldiers. The uprising ended with the Oslo Agreement in 1993, an agreement which granted temporary control over much of the Palestinian territory to the Israeli military and resulted in the formation of the Palestinian Authority. Under the Oslo Agreement, Israeli forces agreed to hand over control of all Palestine to the Palestinian Authority within 5 years in 1998. That handover never happened, however, as the Israeli military solidified its control over more than half of the Palestinian land and moved more than 300,000 civilians into colonies in the occupied territories from 1993 to the present. Despite the withdrawal of 5,000 settlers from the occupied Gaza Strip last year, the overall population of settlements has grown steadily. And this year, the situation in the occupied Palestinian territories has grown considerably worse after an international economic blockade was imposed on Palestine due to the democratic election of the Hamas party in January. Masket Bendel, Director of Positions for Human Rights.
It's very, very difficult to buy medications today. It's also to pay salaries for the employees. Another problem is electricity. The shortage in electricity was caused due to Israel bombing the different infrastructure in the Gaza Strip. The other issue which is very important is the issue of passage in and out of Gaza. Gaza is under strict closure for a few months now. Patients in need of medical treatment which is not available in the Gaza Strip is not allowed to go out to get it in Egypt as they used to.
The construction of the Israeli wall over the last 5 years has also served as a source of tension, as it is being constructed deep within Palestinian territory, apparently in an attempt by Israeli authorities to create new de facto borders for the state of Israel and surround the remaining Palestinian population of 5 million people into enclaves completely surrounded by the wall. For Afasaran from IMEMC.org, this is Saad Manoura in Beth Sahour, Palestine.
Edme Meyers is one of nearly 500 Army Corps of Engineer employees in Iraq. She says she wanted to do her part to serve her country and preserve its values. She will leave knowing that she brought some joy into the lives of children who desperately need some happiness. Off duty, she has devoted her time to helping the children of Iraq. She's been in contact with her friends and family back home to obtain donations of school supplies for Iraqi children. It is not uncommon for children to lack the bare necessities to learn in Iraq. Pencils, books, paper, and school bags are all absent. During a trip to southern Iraq, she handed out teddy bears to the Iraqi children. Meyers has a passion for helping children and takes every opportunity to participate in humanitarian work to provide them with basic necessities. She says that she would like to see all the children in Iraq happy and living peacefully.
British military officers at the highest levels are pressing the government to withdraw from Iraq and concentrate on Afghanistan, according to an exposed Ministry of Defense memo. From London, FSRN's Naomi Fowler reports.
The British government has played down today's leak, claiming there are no disagreements over troop deployments between the Ministry of Defence and the military. The memo written by a naval commander says, quote, British armed forces are effectively held hostage in Iraq. Following the failure of the deal being attempted by the Chief of Staff to extricate UK armed forces from Iraq on the basis of doing Afghanistan, and now we are fighting and arguably losing, or potentially losing, on two fronts. Close quote. But it seems that strong US pressure against British troop withdrawals from Iraq has won the day against the wishes of top military officers, for now. Among officers' concerns is the unpopularity of the Iraq action, low morale and recruitment levels, and high casualty rates in Afghanistan. Top of the list is what they see as the unfair burden being placed on British forces engaged in the so-called War on Terror in Afghanistan. Britain has called on other NATO members to commit 2,500 more troops. But it appears other governments are less keen than the UK in becoming more active US allies. This is Naomi Fowler in London for Free Speech Radio News.
The main former rebel group in the Darfur region of Western Sudan, took two policemen hostage in the capital last night. This after police arrested three of its own members, rebel officials said. Several people were wounded in the confrontation, which ended with the release of all five people, said officials in the Sudan Liberation Movement, which signed a peace agreement in May and has joined the government. In response to the arrest, the Sudanese Liberation Movement leadership sent a group of soldiers from its own militia to the police station to demand the release of the three men. When the police refused, the militiamen took away the police chief and another policeman as hostages. In the resulting gunfight, several people were wounded. In related news, Al-Qaeda's second-in-command, Ayman al-Zawahiri, called on Muslims in a video released today to launch a holy war against UN peacekeepers in Sudan's Darfur region.
Indian authorities plan to nearly double the number of treatment centers providing free drugs and medical care to people infected with the HIV/AIDS virus, a senior official announced today. The National AIDS Control Organization, part of India's health ministry, hopes to reach about 85,000 people with drugs and treatment once all the treatment centers open. India has come under increasing criticism from international health groups for failing to meet the National AIDS Control Organization's own goal of getting free AIDS drugs to 100,000 people by the end of 2005. The UN AIDS Organization said in May that India's 5.7 million infections meant the country has the highest number of people in the world living with HIV. India has more than 1 billion people. The National AIDS Control Organization has increased the number of health centers providing AIDS medicines from 54 to 91 this year, with 9 more centers to open by the end of October.
The U.S. House passed Bill H.R. 4772 today, giving landowners easier access to federal courts when claiming violations of their constitutional rights in land disputes. Until now, people in property disputes have had to travel a lengthy and costly legal path through local appeals boards and state courts. Opponents said quick access to federal courts means costly and difficult legal battles for cities and zoning boards trying to mitigate large developments or ensure their environmental or safety regulations. A representative from New York said of the bill, quote, "Nobody's going to be able to go to their local zoning board and complain." He said, "They'll have to go to the Supreme Court, which won't have time for them," unquote. That's the KBOO Evening News for Friday, September 29th, 2006. If you have any questions or comments about what you heard this evening, or better yet, a news tip, we like getting news tips, please call us at 503-231-8032 and leave a message on extension 203, or you can send an email to pmnews@kboo.org. That's 503-231-8032, extension 203. You're listening to KBOO at 90.7 FM in Portland, in Corvallis at 100.7 FM, and on translator K264AA in Hood River at 91.9 FM on translator K220HR. You can log on to our website at kboo.fm. Our producer for tonight's newscast is Josonia Watson. Our assistant producer is Marlise Franklin. Our wire editors are Josonia Watson and Noah Eaton. Tonight's audio editor is Noah Eaton. Special thanks to KBOO reporters Marlise Franklin and Kathleen Stevenson. Our engineer is Brian Averill. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Lisa Loving. I'm Julie Sabatier.
And I'm Annalisa Hummel. Coming up on Monday, hear the latest on what's happening in your world with KBOO Morning News at 7 o'clock. At 7:30, Cecil and Celeste host More Talk Radio. They'll have an open forum for your calls. At 9 on the Old Mole Variety Hour, the moles dig among the hidden roots of polite society, exposing the foundations of wealth and power. At 10, it's Health Watch with Dr. David Naiman. His guest is Dr. Joseph Medlin, local chiropractor, talking about chiropractic medicine for whiplash and about the principles of chiropractic medicine. At 10:30, it's Monday on the Environment with Scott Forrester. And at 11, it's Democracy Now! That's all right here on KBOO, your non-profit, volunteer-powered and listener-sponsored community radio station. Volunteer with our humble broadcast by calling 503-231-8032, extension 203. Thank you for joining us, and this is what Lily Tomlin has to say. We are all in this together, by ourselves. Good night, Julie.
Good night, Annalisa.
Spin, your weekly look behind the headlines of the mainstream news. I'm Janine Jackson, here with Steve Rendell. This week on Counterspin, as we record the show, the House has passed legislation on military commissions and detainee treatment that will allow forms of detainee abuse recognized internationally as torture, make secret evidence and coerced evidence admissible in court, and degrade habeas corpus, the traditional right of prisoners to challenge their detention. Why are the media largely ignoring the substance and significance of the bill in favor of stories about the political battles over it? We'll talk with Michael Ratner of the Center for Constitutional Rights. Also on the show, FCC Chair Kevin Martin has called for an investigation into the suppression of research that's starting to look like something of a habit for the commission. What was in those studies on media ownership that the FCC disliked so much they had them quashed? We'll hear from Hannah Sassaman of Prometheus Radio Project. That's coming up, but first, as usual, we'll take a look back at the week's press.
In its October 2nd edition, Newsweek reports that in Afghanistan, the religious zealots who harbored Osama bin Laden before 9/11 are surging back into the country's center. Important news? Newsweek thought so. It put the story headlined "Losing Afghanistan" on the covers of its European, Asian, and Latin American editions. The United States, though, was literally a different story. U.S. readers got Annie Leibovitz, My Life in Pictures, a roundup of portraits from the noted celebrity photographer. Ironically, one of the pictures is a group shot of Bush and his national security officials all doing their best to look tough in December 2001, right after the invasion of Afghanistan that Newsweek now reports is not going so well. This may seem like just another example of U.S. media's political timidity, Newsweek thinking that even though its reporters find that the U.S. is losing Afghanistan, it might not be a good idea to be so honest with U.S. readers. But there may be media corruption as well as media cowardice involved. Amidst the spread on the photographer Annie Leibovitz, there are three full-page ads for Nikon cameras. It's obvious that placement of these ads next to this story is no coincidence, even though this violates the traditional journalistic ethic of separating news and advertising. And if Nikon is willing to pay to place its ads next to a particular story, wouldn't it pay more to get its ads in a particular cover story? Newsweek gets more money, Nikon sells more cameras, everybody wins except readers.
It seems one can't go a week without catching another example of mainstream media cautioning the Democratic Party back from the far-left abyss. This week it's Time magazine, and the context is the disastrous effect of liberal blogs. In the September 24th edition, Perry Bacon Jr. traced Connecticut Senator Joe Lieberman's defeat by anti-war challenger Ned Lamont to bloggers who had, quote, fanned anti-incumbent and anti-war flames, close quote. Looking at New York, Bacon wrote that after bloggers, quote, relentlessly derided Senator Hillary Clinton as calculating, overly cautious, and lacking true liberal bona fides, she hired an advisor just to deal with them and even demanded that Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld resign, close quote. His conclusion, quote, progressive bloggers are pushing the Democratic Party so far to the left that it will have no chance of capturing the presidency in 2008, close quote. So, getting leading Democrats to speak out against a war that is overwhelmingly unpopular with the American public is so far to the left as to put the White House out of reach. as is calling for Rumsfeld's resignation, though Time reporters might be expected to know that no less than 6 retired senior generals have publicly called for Rumsfeld to step down in the past year. Presumably, Time would have it that they were victims of the rabid liberal blog's inexorable leftward push as well.
David Ignatius is an Iraq War devotee and a Washington Post columnist. That's not exactly redundant, but it's close. In an indignant September 27th column, Ignatius admitted that things were very bad in Iraq, but then directed his indignation towards Democrats for not coming up with a winning plan. Ignatius even suggested that some were taking satisfaction and political advantage of the dire situation in Iraq. Quote, "Some extreme war critics are so angry at Bush, they seem almost eager for America to lose, to prove a political point. Even among mainstream Democrats, the focus is gotcha, rather than what next?" Close quote. Ignatius seems most angry about calls for troop withdrawal. Quote, "Here's a reality check for the Democrats. There is not a single government in the Middle East, with the possible exceptions of Iran and Syria, that favors a rapid U.S. pullout from Iraq." Close quote. The views of unelected heads of state might be interesting. However, what about democracy? What about what Iraqis think? That same day's Washington Post happened to have 3 reports on Iraqi public opinion, all showing a majority favoring withdrawal. The Project on International Policy Attitudes, for instance, found 71% favoring withdrawal within 6 months, and 61%, including majorities of both Sunnis and Shiites, approving of attacks on American troops. These figures are apparently unimportant to Ignatius, whose dismissal of Iraqi opinion is consistent with his urging Democrats to turn their backs on the majority of Americans who also favor withdrawal. Columnists like Ignatius like to write in lofty terms about democracy, but it's helpful to know that they aren't invoking the will of the people, but a consensus of elites, elected or not.
Elite U.S. media had a field day with Hugo Chavez's September 20th address to the United Nations, in which the Venezuelan president excoriated George Bush and his policies in very colorful terms. A New York Times piece the next day included the notion, attributed to Bush defenders, that at least the United States had let Chavez make his remarks, quote, without being thrown in jail, close quote. Though many might suggest that upholding basic laws of free speech isn't really anything to write home about. The Times piece, which, like much of the coverage, seemed to imply that tough criticism of the U.S. in itself puts someone outside the realm of serious conversation, presented Chavez as in competition with Iranian President Ahmadinejad in what the headline called a battle of anti-U.S. soundbites. It also included what reporters perhaps deemed yet another laughable attribute of the South American leader. He doesn't even know if people he admires are alive or dead. After the UN address, in which Chavez praised a book by U.S. foreign policy critic Noam Chomsky, the Times reports, Chavez told a news conference, quote, that one of his greatest regrets was not getting to meet Mr. Chomsky before he died. Mr. Chomsky, 77, is still alive, close quote. Yes, Chomsky is still alive, though you might not know it from reading the New York Times. And the paper, as it turns out, may not even be right about Chavez's comment. Reuters also covered that news conference, but their September 21st article reports that Chavez, quote, told New Yorkers to read Abraham Lincoln and Mark Twain, as well as modern thinkers like Noam Chomsky and John Kenneth Galbraith, lamenting he could not meet Galbraith before he died in April at age 97, close quote. Careful reader Robert Naiman of the group Just Foreign Policy pointed out the discrepancy in a letter to the Times that the paper didn't publish. Reuters might have it wrong, of course, or the Times might have made a simple translation error. Unfortunately, it's also the case that there are just some people about whom it seems any purported gaffe is worth pointing out, but not necessarily fact-checking.
And finally, in an interview with Barbara Walters on ABC's 2020, Fox's Bill O'Reilly made a dramatic claim that, quote, the FBI came in and warned me and a few other people at Fox News that Al-Qaeda had us on a death list, close quote. Viewers might have a hard time assessing such a claim. On the one hand, O'Reilly has used a prominent media position to advocate for racial profiling of Arab Americans, condone torture in the name of the war on terror, and support the invasion and war on Iraq in terms that could only be called bloodthirsty. On the other hand, not every self-aggrandizing autobiographical tidbit O'Reilly has offered over the years has stood up to examination. Marcus Barham of Radar Online sought to confirm O'Reilly's claim, and after interviewing people at Fox News, ABC, CBS, and the FBI, Barham concluded that the purported threats did not exist. It would be just another O'Reilly make stuff up story, but for the grace note provided by the Fox Network's defense of their star. Fox Media Relations Director Leah Yoon told Barham that the network had, quote, nothing to say about the matter. Why? Because the interview aired on ABC. Quote, we shouldn't be shouldering the burden of something he said on someone else's network, close quote. Once again, journalistic responsibility redefined by the Fox News Channel.
Thank you, Steve. You're listening to Counterspin. Counterspin is brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group Fair.
We are taping this show on September 28th, the day after the U.S. House of Representatives passed legislation on military commissions and detainee treatment, which greenlights detainee abuse, okays internationally recognized forms of torture, and degrades the writ of habeas corpus, the ability to challenge one's detainment, a legal principle rooted in Western tradition going back to the signing of the Magna Carta 800 years ago. But you might not know all this from many mainstream news accounts, which seem to find the substance of the bill a yawn and prefer to focus on the sexy rift between George Bush's White House and those roguish Republican mavericks headed by Arizona's John McCain. When not focused on that rift, reporters largely obsess on how the bill's passage will affect the electoral prospects of Republicans and Democrats this fall. Joining us now to talk about the bill and how it's been covered is Michael Ratner. He's the president of the Center for Constitutional Rights, the leading group fighting for the rights of Guantanamo detainees. Michael Ratner, thanks for joining us today on Counterspin.
Steve, thanks for having me.
Michael, how bad is the legislation?
This is really bad. I remember 5 years ago after 9/11 writing an article called Moving Toward a Police State, or Have We Arrived? Well, you can say we've arrived. This is really about tyranny in America. It deprives people of the most fundamental rights, rights that go back 500 years, one of them, of course, the writ of habeas corpus, which gives you the absolute right to go into a court and challenge your detention. And what this legislation does, it doesn't just degrade habeas corpus, as you said, Steve. It actually abolishes it for aliens anywhere in the world. You can pick up a legal permanent resident in the United States, hold them as a so-called enemy combatant forever, and they never get to go into a court. That's one of the most amazing aspects to me. It obviously goes back to the Magna Carta in 1215. It obviously applies to all of the Center for Constitutional Rights Guantanamo detainees. They're trying to get rid of not only those cases, but they really want the right to set up a police state with regard to aliens, and of course citizens are next. So that's one aspect of the legislation. A second aspect, which has been much talked about, is this question of torture. And of course it's been phrased, and I agreed with that statement that you made, as a debate between the president on one side, McCain, Warner, and Graham on the other, as if somehow there's this serious internal rift in the Republican Party. But let me tell you, there was no internal rift in the Republican Party about habeas corpus, which was barely covered in the press until only recently. And yes, there's been some talking about torture, but no one's really talking about the fact that they sealed that rift, and the bill still allows torture to occur. It sets the parameters of that, allows the president to basically say what kinds of techniques he can use. And yeah, maybe he can't actually put a thumbscrew on you, but he can certainly put you into a stress position, put you through hypothermia, and conceivably put you through mock drowning or waterboarding, as it's called. So it still leaves that very broad authority to the president, not just, first of all, as I said, on habeas to lock you up, but once you're inside, to torture you. And then it does something that's really been outrageous to me, is it immunizes all of the past conduct of people, not just the lower-level CIA guys. I mean, those guys should be worried, but it really immunizes, and in part this bill is about that, immunizes from any future prosecution the Donald Rumsfelds, the Alberto Gonzalez's, the Addingtons, the vice president, or the president, who've essentially authorized war crimes, torture, over the last 3 or 4 or 5 years. And we have a criminal statute making that kind of conduct illegal. And what this bill does is says you have immunity from that. And lastly, as you said, it's called the Military Commission Act. Some 85 or 90 pages of the 95-page act are devoted to military commissions. Now, I should say, in some way, that's a diversion. because, as I said, we got habeas in there, you got torture in there, and you got immunity in there. But on military commissions, it tries to reverse or overturn the case that was decided in June of this year, the Hamden case, that said the president was proceeding unlawfully in trying to try people by military commissions. It doesn't do a good enough job to overturn it, I'll tell you that, because you're still allowed to use evidence that comes in from coercion, which in this administration is really torture. You're still allowed to exclude the defendant from seeing certain evidence, and you're still allowed to bring in all kinds of hearsay evidence. This bill is a disaster. I want to just say, today is the day that we're recording this, that the Senate is voting on this bill. And I just spent 2 days in Washington trying to deal with this bill and the Congress people, or the senators in particular, on the issue of habeas corpus stripping. And I saw the vote, and I really started to cry when I saw it. We lost the vote. We got 48 votes that were going to say we should not strip habeas corpus from people. It's a fundamental right. And 51 votes against this, and we lost it, which means that as you're hearing this program, there is no longer a writ of habeas corpus if you're picked up as an alien anywhere in the world, even in the United States, and held as an enemy combatant.
Michael Ratner, while the press hasn't gotten the historic import of this legislation, there have been exceptions, such as Dan Frumkin at WashingtonPost.com and Dahlia Lithwick at Slate.com. What's your assessment of the press coverage of this legislation?
In some way, they covered this like a football game between two teams that are in the same league. So it was covered by the president on one side and McCain and Warner on the other side, and that was it. And so you never heard a word about habeas corpus. You heard some stuff about torture. You never really heard about how they were immunizing all of these people, which is, of course, illegal to do under international law. The coverage was just terrible. And it took us until the last few days to really begin to get anywhere on the coverage. And, of course, the last few days are quite late. We came close. But there should have been press out there for months saying, what are we talking about? These are fundamental rights, not to be tortured, to have a right to go into court, to have a fair trial. These are rights that are really the core of our American value system, or should be. And the press just was asleep at the switch.
In another exception, Rosa Brooks wrote a scathing denunciation of the military commissions bill in the Los Angeles Times, in which she concluded, Bush isn't stupid. He understands that it's far too late for him to leave a legacy that won't be a source of shame to future generations. So he's going for second best, a congressionally delivered get-out-of-jail-free card. Do you think she's going too far?
I don't think so. I mean, I think when they started torturing people 4 or 5 years ago, the memos that were written said, we better not apply Geneva here, because if we apply Geneva, we might be guilty of war crimes. And they've been concerned by that issue tremendously over the last 4 or 5 years. And when you got a Supreme Court all of a sudden saying, you might be guilty of war crimes because Geneva applies here, these guys got very, very nervous. Some future prosecutor, who knows who they'll go after. And when we look back on this, this will be the shame of this country, much like the Japanese concentration camps were in the Second World War. And there's a good chance that some of these guys could get it, and they're not sleeping well at night. So really what Bush did was really pardon himself and the administration. Rather than having to say, I pardon you, he simply passed a law saying, there's no more criminal law for this anymore, and we make it retroactive. We can't be prosecuted.
On the day we're recording this show, on September 28th, the New York Times ran a very strong editorial condemning this legislation. But it came out the day after the House passed the bill. What do you think about the timing?
Well, the timing was obviously terrible. I mean, my listserv, which we have on Guantanamo, circulated that editorial this morning. The House we had lost. I mean, I have to be honest with you, Steve. We weren't going to win the House. But the day it came out this morning is the Senate vote. And, of course, what could we do with it? They're already on the floor of the Senate voting. Some of them may have read it, but we didn't get to really generate the kind of buzz we needed. And, of course, it should have come out weeks ago. And they used the word in there. They used the word tyranny in there, which is remarkable for the Times, of course. I mean, they've been very slow to getting it, very slow to using the word torture, very slow to talking about the writ of habeas corpus. Finally, on the day of the vote, when basically I'm back here and I've been in Washington for 3 days, and I'm back here now, and what can I do with it? You know, I can hang it on my wall and say, yeah, the Times agrees with me.
We've been speaking with Michael Ratner, the president of the Center for Constitutional Rights. Michael Ratner, thanks for joining us today on Counterspin.
Thank you, Steve.
We told told Counterspin listeners a couple of weeks ago about a 2004 study commissioned by the FCC on the effects of media ownership on local news. It seems that the report, commissioned under then-FCC Chair Michael Powell, didn't find what the agency hoped it would. In any event, the FCC, we now know, ordered it destroyed, literally. And it only came to light when it was leaked to California Senator Barbara Boxer, who questioned current FCC Chair Kevin Martin about it at his renomination hearing. The plot has thickened further now, as it appears the localism study was not the only one the FCC commissioned and then suppressed. A second report has come to light, and there may be more. But as of now, none of this appears to be stopping the FCC from going forward with the latest round of proceedings aimed at reworking media ownership rules. Here to bring us up to date on this evolving story is Hannah Sassaman, an organizer at Prometheus Radio Project. Welcome to Counterspin, Hannah Sassaman.
Thank you so much.
Well, tell us first of all what was in the reports that we know to have been quashed. What was this information that the FCC wanted destroyed?
Well, if you're asking about the second paper that surfaced that Barbara Boxer brought to light at the reconfirmation hearing of Chairman Martin, it was called The Review of the Radio Industry. Now, the FCC internally at its media bureau studies the radio industry periodically and asks questions about concentration, about how well the stations supposedly are serving our American communities. But this particular one from 2003 under Chairman Michael Powell shows that the number of radio station owners had declined due to the consolidation that happened after the Telecommunications Act of 1996 and after the FCC implemented rules which allowed corporations like Clear Channel from owning about 40 stations across the United States to almost 1,300. What this report found, among other things, was while there was a 5.9% increase in the number of radio stations that actually existed around the country, there was a 35% decrease in the number of distinct owners of those radio stations between March 1996 and March 2003. So what we've shown is when the FCC works to consolidate, when our government works to consolidate the ownership of media in the hands of just a few companies, we're looking at a great lack of diversity of voices that happened around the United States. So it proves what we've been saying rather than what they would like us to believe.
And the first study, which we did talk about, but I'll just remind listeners, had to do with showing that when television stations were locally owned, they did in fact do more local news content, which was something else that the FCC had tried to say was not true.
That's right. Almost 5.5 minutes of local news were on each broadcast that was owned by a local company. 5.5 more minutes of coverage of city council meetings, of what's going on at your high school, of what's going on with the local church community, and 3 minutes of on-location news. That adds up to over 30 extra hours of local news that you get from your television stations when they're owned locally rather than by a distant owner like GE or Disney.
And we should be clear, it's not that the FCC released no studies on the potential impact of rolling back regulations. They released a number of them, all tending to support their line that deregulation didn't hurt localism or diversity. Well, for those of us who followed this battle closely over the years, this is all especially galling because FCC Chair Michael Powell went on at fatuous length about the importance of removing emotion from the debate and relying on empirical data. As an institution of government, he told the New York Times in 2001, we have to be able to justify on more than just a sentiment the continuation of a regulatory intervention. And he also said, the problem with diversity is that it has a visceral component. He was very dismissive of opponents to his view, and the thing he used to dismiss us with was research.
I agree. And something else that Michael Powell very famously said was that he waited all night for the angel of the public interest to visit him, to give him the public interest interest in what they cared about in media ownership, and she never came. But ironically, it was the fact that almost 3 million of us told the FCC in very specific anecdotal and statistical detail how media consolidation hurt our communities and how the ownership of local outlets helped us to participate participate in our democracy and in communicating with each other. So our data won and his data lost. And that's exactly why it's so important that now that Chairman Kevin Martin is trying to deregulate the American media system yet again, that we do the same thing that we did in 2003, that we tell the FCC our stories about how local radio stations, when they're owned by distant owners, when they don't let our voices on the air, hurt our ability to participate in the civic life of our community. If we do that, I know that we're going to be beginning to look at a media system that serves our communities much more than it ever did.
Are you encouraging people to communicate directly with the FCC?
Well, it's very easy for anyone who wants to communicate with the FCC to do so right now, because they have opened up a rulemaking asking the American communities if the FCC should be able to allow a company like Clear Channel or a company like Viacom to own both a television station and a newspaper in a single town, for example. You can tell the FCC that you want locally owned, locally controlled media outlets by going to stopbigmedia.com and sending in your comment. They're also going to be holding a number of official hearings around the country, and the first one they're doing is in Los Angeles on October 3rd. But we really need to push for the FCC to keep asking the American public what they want from their media systems for as long as we can, because we've seen that we can't really trust the FCC to even tell us what they've studied when it doesn't prove the points that they want it to prove. So until we can conduct an independent investigation that is totally independent of the FCC as to how media consolidation affects American communities, we need to make sure that they keep accepting our comments and give us as long as possible to tell them what we want from our media system.
And that website again was stopbigmedia.com. Let me ask you finally, Hannah Sassaman, back to the suppressed research story in particular. FCC Chair Kevin Martin has ordered an investigation by the Inspector General into the suppression of at least these two reports that we know about. I want to ask you, as it might even be a side note, but what do you hope for from the press corps on this? We at FAIR were told by one reporter that there's really no story here because he called the FCC and they told him that there was no conspiracy or effort to suppress information. So, you know, there's no story. What are you looking for from reporters, or what would you hope for from reporters on covering this story?
Well, I think it's really important to state, Janine, is that in 2000 and 2001, the effects of media consolidation were considered to be one of the most censored, one of the least told stories in the United States by Project Censored, which regularly covers stories that we don't hear about because the conglomerate media in the United States decides not to tell us. And so, first of all, the media needs to be reminded that they didn't do a very good job last time, and they haven't done one for years. The second thing that they need to realize is that the communities across the United States understand in very sophisticated ways the relationship between all of the different media owners and the different kinds of telecommunications and media they get in their homes. They understand that when the FCC works to consolidate cable corporations and when state governments work to remove our rights to build community wireless networks, we know that it's the same companies pushing for this activity. So when reporters are covering this issue, what they're going to be faced with are extremely sophisticated, well-educated, diverse community members and citizens across the United States who understand it when corporations rob them of their rights. And so I would look to reporters to talk to those individuals and to get the story straight from them rather than just printing a press release directly from the FCC, from Comcast, from Clear Channel, or from NBC.
We've been speaking with Hannah Sassaman of Prometheus Radio Project. Thank you very much for joining us today on Counterspin.
Thank you very much.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by the staff and interns at FAIR, the Media Watch Group. The show is engineered by Alex Noyes at Mercer Media. With me is Steve Rendell. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.